from somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, this is turning out to be just one incredible evening tonight. I tell you what we're going to do. In a moment, my guest will be Brian Belitsos. We're going to talk with Brian about something that so many of you have asked me to check into called The Book of Urantia. This is just a huge book, and it deals with the universe, the history of the earth, God. And we're going to chat with Brian about that for the next couple hours. We're going to take some phone calls next hour with Brian. But because of some things that are also happening around this planet, the last hour here on Coast to Coast, I'm going to open up the phone lines for open lines, primarily because of the fact that on Friday at 3 o'clock Eastern time, we are going to get hit with a huge coronal injection from the sun. I mean, this is huge. It's already on the way, and it could affect us for anywhere from 12 to 18 hours. And they don't know how it's going to affect us. So I want to chat with you about that in the last hour of the program. In addition to that, if you can get up to the Coast to Coast AM website under Hot Stories, take a look at the story about Jupiter. As you know, we sent the Galileo space probe crashing into Jupiter in September, and there were a few people thought that that was not a wise thing to do because of the plutonium. Well, all of a sudden, there is now a very strange dark circle on the planet, and astronomers have no idea what it is. They have no idea what it is. So I want you to take a look at that, and we're going to talk about that, too, on the last hour here of Coast to Coast. But in a moment, we're going to talk about the Book of Urantia, and it's going to be fascinating. Don't go away. Couple quick stories, too. Believers in New Jersey are flocking to a rundown street in New Jersey to see a tree stump that they say has the form of the Virgin Mary, and they claim is a divine sign of hope for the impoverished neighborhood. They call it the Miracle on Madison Street. That's what they would have called it, says Hector Cruz, who visited the roughly 2-foot-high stump in New Jersey's Hispanic area. The piece of wood, whose shape believers say resembles a veiled Virgin Mary with a bowed head, as it's bowed, has noticed by passersby over the weekend on state-owned land alongside a street, and they believe that maybe it's a message. And also, the actor who plays Jesus in Mel Gibson's film The Passion of Christ has escaped injury after being struck by lightning during the filming. I kid you not. It's the second time that a lightning bolt has hit that movie set in Italy. The crew was on a remote location a few hours from Rome when the storm occurred, and they saw lightning coming out of the star's ears. He's okay. He's all right. Jim Caviezel, C-A-V-I-E-Z-E-L, and just a strange, strange story. Well, now we're going to talk about the Book of Urantia. Brian Belitsos is an author, journalist, publisher. He's the founder and CEO of the Origin Press, an award-winning book publishing company. He is also the publisher of the website www.ikosmos.com, ikomos.com, known as the portal for cultural creativity. Brian has been a student of the Urantia book for 29 years and has written and spoken widely on its teachings. He has a BA in intellectual history from the University of Chicago. His graduate studies have embraced history, literature, philosophy, and religious studies and were conducted at the Naropa Institute at the University of California and at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Brian has co-authored, published two books about the Urantia book entitled The Center Within, Lessons from the Heart of the Urantia Revolution, and The Secret Revelation, Unveiling the Mystery of the Book of Revelation. His forthcoming commentary on the Urantia book is entitled Romancing the Universe, A Guide to the Mysteries of the Urantia Revelation. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hello, Brian. How are you?
I'm just great. Thank you, George.
It's my pleasure to have you. You know, I have been doing the program now for a little more than 3 years, and I have within every week, gotten some emailings from people wanting to know more about the Book of Urantia, to the point where I said, you know what? I'm going to start finding out about this, and I have, and I'm glad you're on tonight, so you can explain to us just what this book is, because it's huge. It's, I don't, what would you call it? Is it a book on philosophy about life? How would you categorize it?
You know, the Urantia book, George, has so many areas that it covers in detail that it's hard to put it in any particular category. I would personally call it a revelation about science, philosophy, history, and the life of Jesus. And, you know, before I go on, I want to just simply acknowledge you and the show for covering the Urantia book. Okay. For Urantia book readers, this is like a milestone and, in fact, cause for celebration that your show has the courage and the foresight to cover something which we think is of epical importance for the whole planet.
Well, you know, I want people to understand things, and you know, this is something that has been around for a long time, and I just think it's important that people get information that they normally would not. I honestly probably would never have known about it had I not been getting emails over the last several years about it. So I think it's necessary to do that. And by the way, nowhere in this book, because I'm sure because it is just something that is different, nowhere in this book have I seen anything that has to do with evil or anything like that. If anything, Byron, it is a book on humanity first and foremost, and I just wanted everybody to know that. This is not a slam at religion by any means.
It's really a gift to humanity, and it's a gift to the planet. And yes, it's certainly not a slam on other religions. In fact, one of the chief purposes of the Urantia book is to find a way to harmonize all of the so-called evolutionary religions and to, in the future, bring our planet to a place of unity in our spirituality. Not that there would be specifically one world religion, but that there would be a unity of spirit feeling, you might say, that everyone on our planet has access to the presence of God and the Spirit of God, which is within and transcendent.
Now, you call this book, Byron, almost a book of revelation. Explain that for a moment.
Urantia book readers, by and large, think of this book as a revelation, an epical revelation to our planet from an organized core of celestial beings whose mandate was to update for us our own history, in particular the life of Jesus, but also to give us the background, the context, the really big picture on our universe, or as it puts it, the universe of universes.
I mean, because it gets into the cosmos, life after death. It talks about angels. It talks about Adam and Eve. I mean, it gets into a lot of things. Who wrote it?
That's a very interesting question that many writers and all of us who read the Urantia book have taken a stab at. And there's significant disagreement as to exactly what the history of the early revelation was, but what we do know is that there was a core of there was a group of human beings who in Chicago beginning about 1910 were contacted and had sort of informal discussions with celestial beings who at a certain point decided to announce to them that they wanted to present an epical revelation to them and through them to the world.
Well, now what kind of celestial beings are we talking about?
These are beings who come from a very high place, George. They come from the center of our galaxy, according to the Urantia book, and even from a higher place than that, which is called paradise.
All right. Are these more spiritual as opposed to thinking about extraterrestrials on another planet?
Yeah, they're very high spiritual beings who are, you might say, super angels.
Okay, these individuals that were approached in 1910, who were they? I mean, why them?
There was a particular very talented psychiatrist named William Sadler, Dr. William Sadler, who was brought into a situation in which there was a person who was being contacted, and it was a great mystery for the folks around this person, and they invited Dr. Sadler to come in to analyze what was occurring, and he became really the early facilitator of the revelatory process. And it's quite a story, because he wasn't sure what exactly was happening, and one of his almost hobbies was to debunk this kind of phenomenon. In fact, he wrote books debunking psychics and mediums in that period, which were very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a very good candidate to be brought into this. If there were an ethical revelatory process, you'd want to have someone who was a skeptic and a scientist and a highly trained thinker and intellectual, a man of his time. So he was the one who really organized this small group of people who came to be called the Contact Commission. The Contact Commission was a group of six or seven people who were the ones around the person who was called the Contact Personality. And the Contact Personality is not known who this man is.
Now, is that a human being?
It is a human, and he elected to go anonymous. We do not know the man's name, and to this day, those who know who he was have all died.
And I assume he's probably dead now, too.
And he died quite a long time ago.
Okay. 1910. How were they approached, Byron? Were they approached in some kind of physical manifestation, or did it come in via telepathy? How did it happen?
You might think of it like Edgar Casey, that there was somebody who was in a very deep rest, a sleeping subject, as they call it, quite like Edgar Casey, where the person was unable to be roused from sleep, and while he was in this deep state of rest, was able to bring through these voices of these extraterrestrial beings who were actually spiritual beings.
And they just kept, the small group of humans just kept writing whatever they believed they were told?
There was a stenographer who was taking down what was being stated through this man. But there were many other phenomena, George, that of which, again, there's disagreement as to exactly what happened, and a lot of it is just not recorded. But there was a revelatory process in which eventually, through this person, papers would come through. And there are a lot of papers. There's 196 papers.
Oh, this is a huge. Now, and when you say 196 papers, you're not saying 196 pages. This is a big book.
Over 2,000 pages.
Yep. Okay.
So this material is coming through this guy, and there's a small group who are around him. And in the beginning, it's sort of informal, and these people are being sort of tutored by these personalities that they can't see, who are speaking through this person and writing through this person, and presenting documents and ideas and teachings about the universe that were vastly beyond what anybody had heard before, and to this day, vastly beyond any other literature that personally I've ever heard of.
And what we'll do throughout this evening is talk about some of these various aspects and have you give us the perspective of what was in the book. Was it at the how long did it take them to assemble it? Now, it comes to them in 1910. I assume they can't do this in a few weeks. How long did it take?
Quite a long time, George. It was over 30 years, because from the beginning of these contacts, and again, there's not much known about it, but at a certain point, as I said, the revelators said, we're going to have now a formal process, and that begins around 1925, of presenting actual chapters or papers, which will become this great text over time. So at this point, the scene sort of changes from the small group of people around Dr. Sadler to a larger group who were specifically invited. He was asked to bring this larger group in and have them read the papers as they came through this unknown personality. And so from here, you have an additional period up to 1934 of papers coming through, and this group called the Forum actually reading the papers. It's an amazing scene to think of, reading these papers, which were typed up from a stenographer, typed up, and they would read the papers and then feed questions back in to the contact commission, those humans who were around this contact personality, and go back and forth with these celestial personalities, asking them questions and about these papers that would come through, and refining the, you know, the revelators would refine them over these years to get them something to into a state that the humans at that time and that place could understand.
Why did it remain such a mystery? Because, like I say, you know, even I think that I do a pretty darn good job researching, reading, and I have all my life. I just never knew about this. Why is this book such a closed mystery?
You know, it appears to be that way, George, to a lot of people, that this is sort of inaccessible and it's this mystery and what is it? In fact, you know, it's not even clear to folks what the name is. The name of the book is the Urantia Book or the Urantia Papers. Mm-hmm. I like to call it the Urantia Revelation. But, you know, you don't see it anywhere in the media. In the early years, the group that grew up around the Urantia Book was committed to the idea of word-of-mouth spreading of these teachings and of the book itself. There has never been advertising. There's never been a crusade, you might say, to present the papers to the world. And by word of mouth, 500,000 books have been disseminated. So it's gotten around. But until recently, nobody was writing about it, publishing about it, or, you know, writing magazine articles or anything of that nature. Now in the 90s, it began to happen, and I'm an example of that. I started a publishing company in part to publish books about the Urantia Book.
Does the Urantia Book kind of digest the Bible? Is it a different book from the Bible? Does it augment the Bible? What is it?
That's a great question, George. And, you know, the Urantia Book is an enhancement of the teachings in the Bible. You might say it's like a 1-to-10 ratio. That's one way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
That any given scene, say, in the New Testament of Jesus interacting with the apostles or teaching, you take any one of those scenes and you have 10 times more information about that in the Urantia Book.
Ah, okay.
It is believed that the teachings, the life and teachings of Jesus in the Urantia Book are the angelic record of what he actually did and said.
So what it does is it really expounds upon what was in the Bible, whatever it may be, a specific phrase, a chapter, and then it's almost like another book all by itself.
You might say that it's a Bible for the 21st century, or for actually the next millennium. I personally wouldn't call it a new Bible, but I would say that it's here to correct the Bible, and where there may be inaccuracies, in as much as the Bible was written by human authors, and some, of course, were inspired, but to particularly take the life of Jesus, which is presented beautifully and gorgeously in the New Testament, but to give us a picture of this amazing incarnate God.
All right, I want to get your take on the cosmos, what you think, based in this book, what the universe is like, to find out if it too has an apocalypse, and what it has to say about angels. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment as we talk about the Urantia Book on Coast to Coast AM.
This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, at the top of the hour, next hour, we're going to open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Byron about the Urantia book. And then the last hour on Coast to Coast, because of the very strong possibility that we're going to be blasted at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern time by a coronal eruption, a huge eruption that could really disrupt all kinds of services. I want to open up the phone lines and get some of your thoughts about that, in addition to this very strange spot that they have just spotted that is on the face of Jupiter. And you can see that picture on the coasttocoastam.com website. Byron Belitsos, my guest. We're talking about the Urantia book. Byron, does the book get into the universe, how it was formed? Does it take a scientific look at it, or more of a spiritual look?
It's both, George. It's both science, philosophy, and religion, and it harmonizes each of those in this beautiful discourse that gives you a kind of seamless explanation of the entire universe and also the history of the universe. And then in the foreground is the history of our planet leading up to this picture of the life of Jesus, as I mentioned.
Okay, now, because you say that the book was, I guess, written in part, if not entirely, by celestial beings, do you have any special feeling about physical extraterrestrial life, or does the Urantia book mention that at all?
Yes, it very definitely does. And I think one of the things that's of great interest to your listeners is that the Urantia book talks about life on other planets and has, I think, more extensive information on extraterrestrial life than anything I've ever seen. It goes into some detail about the kinds of planets out there and the kinds of beings, humanoid beings, that can live in very different conditions on planets, and tells us that there are not millions, not billions, but trillions of inhabited planets in the grand universe.
Trillions?
Trillions.
That's loud. You know what? That's exciting to know. I mean, there's nothing more, I think, depressing than to think we're alone in this universe. It's so grand, it's kind of lonesome, don't you think?
You know, it feels like we're orphans. And we're just stuck on this planet, and in fact, we don't really know who our parents are either. And that's really what the Urantia book is about too, is to introduce us to our divine father and mother. And that gets into the religious aspect of the Urantia book, which is stunning, extraordinary, and life-changing for thousands of us.
Well, tell me a little bit about what it describes these humanoids to be. I find this to be very fascinating.
It says so many interesting things. For example, it says that one of the most important variables on an inhabited planet is the atmosphere of the planet. Some, you might just kind of look at our solar system and look at Mars, which has a thin atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It says that there are types of beings that can live in that kind of atmosphere. Ideally, you have an atmosphere like ours, but then you could have an atmosphere like that on the moon, which has nothing to breathe. And it says that, in fact, there can be a certain type of being called non-breathers that can live with an atmosphere like that, but it's fairly rare. You could have a planet like Venus, which has this dense atmosphere, and, you know, very different from the other three I've just discussed.
So those kinds of planets don't have to be Earth-like.
They do not have to be Earth-like to have life. And this is one of the chief revelations of the Urantia book about life, that our scientists think you have to have Earth-like conditions.
Yes.
But it says that's the ideal. But those super angel beings, there's a certain type of being that actually designs life and plants it on a planet. And when they see a planet's evolved and without an atmosphere for various reasons, then they plant a certain type of life that can thrive in without an atmosphere, or an atmosphere that's very dense, like Venus. It's possible to have beings that can live in that kind of atmosphere.
Now, in the Urantia book, is this creation of this other life under the plan of a master builder, basically?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. There is a sort of master architect of life, and of course of the physical universe as well. And ultimately, it's God the Father and God the Mother. And then they downstep themselves and their powers and distribute themselves so that their powers can be delegated, so to speak, to beings who are, you might say, descending down toward us in terms of their abilities and their powers. And so there are creator beings who are not specifically God the Father.
Does it recognize angels, and does it also make reference to, as we've always been told, fallen angels?
Yes, both of them, George. And here I go again with another superlative. But the Urantia book, the discussion of angels, or the angelology of the Urantia book, is in itself a very important revelation about angels. And as you asked, there is such a thing as fallen angels, and that's one of the key reasons we have the Urantia book, is to explain to our planet why it is that we have such travail and such difficulty, such a warlike planet. It's because there was a phenomenon of the fall of the angelic beings who were overseeing our planet.
You know, you may be onto something with that, or the Urantia book may be, because I have always wondered if this kind of hatred on this planet is universal, or if it's just within this planet, or maybe just a few. And then when you look at the stories of fallen angels and what happened, you begin to think, is that the reason why there's so much evil on this planet? And I assume the book of Urantia kind of backs that up, huh?
That I would say. Sarah, some people would say that's one of the top two or three themes and revelations of the Urantia book, is that we were subject to a rebellion of angels and even super angels in our part of the inhabited universe, the local system of planets.
Just our luck, right?
Yeah. Terrible luck for us and 35 other planets. In fact, there were other planets that went into rebellion following a high being named Lucifer, whose lieutenant was Satan. So what the Bible says about that, using those names,
all right,
is correct, but it's just a very tiny bit of information, and the Urantia book has much, much more about that.
All right, let's talk about this fall. Was it an internal conflict war here?
You might say an internal conflict within the angelic hierarchy. You know, if you kind of look top down on the local system of planets, and a system of planets, the unit is 1,000 inhabited planets. In that local system, the angelic hierarchy, so to speak, that oversees the activity, and there's a lot of activity when you have a lot of planets and a lot of beings. The actual administrator in charge of the local system, Lucifer, became, you might say, in love with himself, just like the Bible says.
Okay, and he was like a commanding officer of a certain region.
Of this region,
okay,
of inhabited planets.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Relatively small when you think about trillions of planets, but, you know, for us, it's devastating.
Sure.
And all encompassing rebellion, because there is such a thing as a planetary, what is called planetary prince, which is sort of the main super angel.
And they were not physical, right?
Yeah, these are angels. They're non-physical. And each planet has this being who oversees the planet. And then each group of a thousand planets has this sort of super administrator that oversees them. So that hierarchy, which has lots of different types of angelic orders within it, that hierarchy went astray and actually fell into sin and evil.
Okay, now when you say they went astray, I mean, first of all, I'm trying to figure out how something angelic, non-physical, can go astray. So help me out a little bit there. What are some of the things they did in order for that to happen?
George, this is one reason the Urantia book is so thick, and people wonder, why do we need this 2,000-page tome to explain this? One needs to understand the nature of the angelic hierarchy. You need to understand what evil and sin and iniquity is. And to understand that, you need to understand who God is and God's love. And God's love for us is shown in the fact that God grants free will to us. And angels, too, have free will. They're not forced to follow the will of God. And, you know, this is biblical, too. You're right.
And, you know, I keep thinking of, you know, to put it into my perspective with my small mind, it's like the City of Angels with Nicolas Cage. I don't know if you ever saw that movie. But
I actually didn't see that.
He was an angel. And same kind of thing. They had free will. And that's important for everybody to know that.
That the angels can make mistakes, and the Urantia book tells us that they made a very devastating error. It's not all of the angels of our planet and of the local system, but like I said, the certain set of planets went, the majority of their angels followed Lucifer into a rebellion against the divine plan for their planet.
Okay.
Which is, in essence, the divine plan is evolution and respect for the free will of every single being human on that planet.
Now, do you think our planet was already formed when this thing happened?
Well, the Urantia book, you know, is said to be the fifth epochal revelation, and the planet had been formed, it had been populated, and there are actually five revelations. The reason I'm telling you, George, is that this is a way of explaining this rebellion. Each planet has a divine plan, where beings come from another place to the planet, first of all, to plant the life, as I mentioned earlier. And once human beings evolve after millions of years, then there's a new revelatory, the first revelatory commission, and that group is the coming of the government of the planet, which that being the celestial government. And you can't see them, except there's a group of visible beings that come with them. And this happened 500,000 years ago. That group is the group that went astray initially.
Okay, so they go astray. Some of them come down to the planet, don't they?
They're on the planet. These are actual angelic beings who are on the planet and some who are visible. So you might really say those are extraterrestrial.
Right, right. Yes. And I guess they start... So how does this planet pick up that evilness from them, I guess?
Yeah, well, let me bring in Zechariah Sitchin.
Okay.
Because his work correlates in broad outline to this. He says that there were these sort of extraterrestrials that came here, and they had a particular project, and there was a rebellion. And it's kind of, the timeline is roughly the same. He says it began about 500,000 years ago, and then about 200,000 years ago, there was this rebellion. And so, his interpretation doesn't match too many other features of the Urantia book, but it's uncanny how it matches the timeline. But truly, these extraterrestrials and these angelic beings who were not seen, because they basically went on a different plan. You might say it was sort of like communism as compared to democracy, where there's a sort of dictator angel accelerating and having a revolutionary changes in the planet to accelerate and not go according to a slow evolutionary plan that respects the free will of each person. And that would include even the most, you know, dull-witted person.
So you think, though, the Sumerian texts that Sitchin has analyzed might be pretty accurate?
Yeah, it seems to Urantia book readers who look into this that the Sumerian texts and the fragmentary evidence of prehistory is about this story that the Urantia book gives you,
right.
You know, much more, you know, so there's lots going to be written about that coming up.
Now, does that also mean there's a Planet X out here somewhere?
There was nothing about Planet X in the Urantia book, that theory from Sitchin doesn't match.
Okay. Not to say it doesn't exist, but the Urantia book doesn't write about it.
It doesn't write about that these beings came from this other planet. No, they're actually coming from higher planets, not physical planets, but from a higher planet. You might say etheric, and the Urantia book has its own word for that, morontial. These are planets made of a higher material. So these celestial beings actually have planets that they live on that we can't see. And they came from there, and Sitchin says they came from a material planet.
So do you think that these fallen angels that apparently started breeding with Earth women,
yes,
that was the catalyst for creating offspring who, I guess, picked up part of what we are now, and this is that part of evil that some of us have?
You know, the Bible, George, says, you know, that we inherited sin almost genetically, and that Jesus incarnated and died, you know, to save us from that sort of curse of the sin of Adam and Eve. And, you know, it's mythic, of course, it's mythic language, but there's something to that. But it isn't particularly specifically like a genetic inheritance of something evil, but it is the case that the genetic impact of these beings on us would have been different if they had not gone astray. And what we need to do is we need to talk about Adam and Eve now, because that's a different period of time from this first period of time, the first period being half a million years ago.
And who do you think Adam and Eve were? So many people think maybe they were space travelers, for example.
Well, there's something, you know, you might say that the Urantia folks would say that they are of extraterrestrials of a sort who came here somewhat later than this other group that we were just talking about. They came 35,000 years ago, and every planet, believe it or not, gets their own Adam and Eve, and these are biological uplifters. They bring a genetic, they actually inject their genes in the genetic pool by breeding a race on the planet, which then intermarries with the indigenous beings. How do you like that?
I like that.
So the stories, and there's so many interesting books now on tracking this down. There must have been some sort of extraterrestrial intervention at different times, as Sitchin says. And then there must have been something in a more recent period, and the Urantia book reveals, and Urantia book believers believe, that Adam and Eve actually came with that project. This is part of the divine plan.
Mm-hmm.
But even they, George, went astray. So this is, again, why the Urantia book is so difficult and so thick, because you have these two defaults, these two rebellions, really. The first one is that first group following Lucifer.
Mm-hmm.
And then those angels are still around, you see. They're still on the planet, these fallen angels.
Well, do you believe in this evil place called hell?
No, the Urantia book says that's a myth.
Okay, so that's where it differs.
That's a very big, that's a mythic concept. There's no hell sort of down there, down below. There is in heaven, there is a kind of a place where people are put for remediation, like limbo, like the Catholics say.
Right.
But it's not a hell where you get punished. And it's very contrary to the teachings of the Urantia book that there would be a God who punishes.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We'll also open up phone lines as well, continue chatting about the book of Urantia.